This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, you'll meet the owners of the Los Osos-based company Rantech Power Systems.
Yeah, I'd say our growth isn't really necessarily around the smaller personal aircraft. That's more along the lines of what's in the defense spending budget and where things are going from that perspective.
Also, C-suite consultant and Arroyo Grande resident Harpreet Guman shares her life journey and her new book, Living and Loving Unapologetically.
My real goal for this book is to help women rediscover the dreams that got buried long time back while they were busy supporting or fulfilling dreams of their partner or kids or aging parents.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, July 8th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a conversation with Connie Framberger. She offers a close-up look at last August disaster in Maui and what's needed now.
Hello, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Connie Framberger, local resident and retired insurance executive, to talk about the Maui wildfires. Welcome, Connie.
Thank you very much, Brian.
It's a real treat to have you, although the subject is dark. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how is it you became to be a part-time resident of Maui?
Happy to. My husband and I have been visiting Maui since our very early marriage. We went about 2 years after we got married back in 19. We got married in 74, 76, I think, was our first trip to Maui, and we just fell in love with it. And then as often as we could afford to go, we would go. And then slowly it became every year we went there on vacation. So people here often go to the lake. We went to Maui, and we just fell in love with it. It's a very magical, magical place. We were fortunate enough in 2017 to be able to purchase property there. And so now we go as often as we possibly can.
So do you have a condo or do you own a home?
We do. It is a condo in a complex that is all privately owned. Each unit is owned privately. So you're able to decorate it in the style that you'd like to decorate it. And then some of the condos, ours included, we rent out when we're not there.
Sure. Walk us through the horrific wildfires in Maui, when that took place. Has there ever been anything like that before? Just give us some broad brush descriptions, please.
Sure. Happy to. Well, it happened on August 8th of last year. So 2023, August 8th is when it ignited. And there have been other fires, especially in Lahaina, almost always due to a hurricane. The reason this one was so unique is because it was a hurricane with hurricane force winds, but no rain. And so the wind in combination with some down power lines is what ignited the fire in Lahaina. The one in upcountry, because there were two fires that happened on Maui on that same day. One was upcountry in the little town of Kula, which is on the side of Haleakala. Very different scenic area than Lahaina, but both of them were intense fires, whipped by the winds and uncontrollable.
So there have been minor things in the past, but nothing like this.
Nothing like this. Nothing that wiped out an entire town. And it really, truly wiped out the entire town of Lahaina.
We, many of us who've lucky enough to have been to Hawaii a few times. I haven't been to Maui, I've been to Kauai and loved it quite a bit. But I think there's something magical about those islands and spiritually, geographically, weather, everything. What makes Maui special? What made it special for you and your husband over the years?
You know, that's a real hard thing to answer because for us, it's more of a feeling than a concrete thing that made it special. The minute we get off that plane and we feel that moist, humid, warm air, it just penetrates to our very souls, and it just is special. We've run into several people that think the same thing about Maui. They feel like it's a magical place. Some people don't think it's a magical place, but for us, it's very, very magical. We love the people. We love the fact that it is a state. It's in the United States, so we don't really need to learn a foreign language to be able to communicate. It's just, and it's gorgeous, absolutely stunningly gorgeous.
What, before we get into more details of the fire, what are the, if there are any, bicultural issues there? For example, Native Hawaiians and tourism, Native Hawaiians and even people like yourself who aren't really, couldn't be considered tourists anymore. But are there any strengths or weaknesses in those relationships?
Well, yes and no. And it depends on the person involved. It is a very cultural place. The Hawaiian people are very special people. They have a very different than mainland culture. They're very proud people. They love their land. The fact that it used to be agricultural and now has been converted into a tourist island is difficult for many of them. And the only jobs really that are available, or some of the few jobs, are in tourism. So really they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them, but yet you can certainly understand that if you had a place that was gorgeous and survived on agriculture and then turned into tourism, so you had different people coming every week to your homeland, it would just be very difficult. We have found that the people that we've met and grown to love on the island accept us, appreciate us, and especially after the fire when we went to help out, it was open arms.
Now, speaking of helping out, I know since we're, by way of self-disclosure, we're both members of the San Luis Obispo Rotary Club, mm-hmm. the Monday Club, and I remember you collecting donations and other kinds of things and taking them. Could you talk a little bit about what you did and why and how that worked out?
Sure, happy to. Well, the fire happened on August the 8th. We originally had tickets to leave to go on our, quote, vacation, unquote, on the 9th of August, and we were going to stay for a month and a half. And, of course, our flight was canceled. We heard about the fire. We knew that we couldn't get in, even if the airline had flown us there. So we waited until the airline would permit us to fly there, and when they opened the road. There is only one road that goes to West Maui, and it was closed for about 10 days, and so we couldn't get through. As soon as they opened the road, we went. But in that time, I just put the word out that we were going to Maui. We knew people had needs. They had financial needs. They had physical needs. They needed clothing. They needed toiletries. They needed absolutely everything because they were evacuated at the very last minute and lost absolutely everything. And so the generosity of San Luis Obispo and the surrounding communities was just amazing. We took a chunk of change. We took socks. We took underwear. We took swimsuits. We took toys. We took as much as we could possibly cram into our allowable luggage. The kind of amusing thing is we knew that people needed cash. So we didn't want to just take checks. We didn't want to take credit card numbers. We didn't want to do any of that. So we took cash, and I decided to not put it in my checked luggage for fear that if, for whatever reason, it got lost or if it got searched or whatever, people would find a ton of cash. So I took it in my carry-on and managed to stuff thousands and thousands of dollars inside the lining of my carry-on.
Oh, my.
So I was really excited that my husband and I both had pre-checks, so they didn't actually go through our carry-on because I thought that would look awfully suspicious to have cash tucked in the side pockets. But when we got there, we checked in, we got into our condo, talked to some of the people who had survived the fire and were housed in our complex. Many of the people that work in our complex were also housed in our complex, asked what their needs were, and they ranged from school supplies for their kids, even though the school burned down, underwear, socks, toiletries, trying to remember what else we bought, toys. These kids evacuated and they had no toys. And so we used the money to buy toys. We used it to buy school supplies for kids in hopes that they'd be able to go back to school pretty soon. We bought some specialized things. We hooked up with the Red Cross as soon as we got there and asked them what their needs were for the survivors. And so every day the Red Cross would come to us and say, okay, here's what we need. We need baby formula. We need baby diapers. We need this. We need a special medication that can only be bought in Kahului or Waialuku. So pretty much every day, my husband and I got in our car and drove into the major cities of Maui and bought the supplies that people needed and brought them back. They also needed documentation. These people left without their licenses. They evacuated without their credit cards, without their birth certificates, their passports, their every imaginable piece of documentation was lost. So we helped people actually get documentation, which wasn't as hard as it may seem.
So you were your own banker. You didn't give people cash. You gave them, you purchased items that they were an explicit need for.
No, we also gave them cash. We had, as I said, the generosity of the local people here toward the people there was amazing. So we actually did give people cash. And we tried to break it down into, if you're a single person, you get this much. If you're a married couple, you get this much, and then so much more per child, just so that they could get through a couple of weeks of groceries. And they weren't paying any rent. Red Cross was taking care of rent for them, but just, you know, those basic needs, prescriptions.
So refreshing, I have to say, to try to do a good, or actually to accomplish various good deeds without the hurdles and barriers of red tape and government overreach and different things.
Right. One of the things we did as soon as we got there was put a big board in the lobby of our complex that said, what are your needs? Here's what we can provide. And so we had little stick-it notes, little post-it notes, and some people would say, well, gee, if you could make a birthday cake for my son, or if you could buy this or buy that. And so we had a needs and a wants board, and that was really, really effective. That's where we got the request for a lot of toys and for school supplies and whatnot. The kids there, we had no power for about a week after the fire. And so then after that, we had no internet and no cable TV. So the kids were bored. They had no school. They were totally bored. So we really tried to entertain and occupy the children at this time. Then they finally hooked us up with Starlink so the kids could do remote school. But there was just a disassociation with the children that really to this day has me worried, that they survived this horrible evacuation. Some of them lost family members and friends, so they were grieving. They lost all their personal possessions. They couldn't go to school and chat with their friends. It was just a huge void in their lives. Parents were difficult also, but I really worried about the kids, especially the teenagers.
I'd like to remind everybody, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Connie Framberger, a SLO resident, retired insurance executive, and a resident part-time of Island of Maui. Let's imagine, Connie, based on what you know, both from hearing from people in the news reports and actually being there, help us imagine that we're a fly on the wall on August 8th or 9th of last year. We're in. Walk us through what happened.
Well, we weren't there, so it's all hearsay. And I'll tell you, the rumors were fast and furious when we did get back to our beloved island. We know many people who did lose absolutely everything. So what I'm going to tell you is what we heard from them. One of the big controversies is the fact that they didn't set off the alarms. They didn't blow the horns in all of Maui to warn of the fire coming. And part of the reason for that is that it started as a very small fire that they thought they had extinguished. But clearly there were several embers, and due to the crazy winds, they reignited and then the fire spread. But the only alarm system that they have on the island is for tsunamis. And the locals are all very familiar with that warning. And the officials were afraid that if they did the tsunami warning, that people would head uphill, because that's what you are trained to do. You go uphill.
Away from the beach.
Away from the beach. And that's where the fire was coming from. So they were afraid people would drive right in to the fire. So they did not sound the alarms. Several weeks after we got there, there was another fire, and they did sound the alarms when they evacuated us. So they kind of learned from their mistakes in that respect. Our understanding is that it caught people very unaware. The locals who had lived there all their lives could tell by the nature of the wind and how impactful the wind was and the way that it was swirling and had no direction, they knew it was going to be trouble. And so the minute they smelled smoke, they evacuated. Other people were not quite that aware, especially the tourists that were there and staying there, didn't realize that this smoky smell and this crazy wind would create such a hazard. But it did come down into Lahaina fast and furious. There were many people who did not have the opportunity to escape. We did lose a friend who lived with his mother. He's in his 50s, she's in her 80s, and he got her out, and she ran to the seawall, jumped into the ocean, and stayed in the ocean for 6 hours. We're not sure what happened. We think he maybe turned around to grab something, or maybe a tree fell on him or whatever, but he did not survive the fire. So it was that irregular and that unpredictable that many people could not escape.
What was then, just in terms of clock time, what was the window once people knew there were serious things going on or the evacuation order came? Was it a half hour? Was it a half a day?
It wasn't a half a day. If it was a half a day, I'm sure we would not have lost 102 people. From what I understand, around 7 o'clock is when people started to leave, and around 8 o'clock is when that fire just whipped through the town of Lahaina. It gets darker in Hawaii than it does here. They don't have daylight savings time. And so right around 7 o'clock is when sundown would happen. And so, yeah, that's our understanding. Right around 7 o'clock, it got really nasty.
I know the governance in Hawaii is a little bit different. What kind of support or first responder help was provided? Was it the local fire department? Was there higher level National Guard?
It was the fire department. The fire department and the fire department from the entire island. And keep in mind, there were two fires going on, one in Lahaina and one in Kula. So they were really divided. The big city fire departments, one went one direction, one went in the other direction. But there was just no way that they could combat a fire this intense, this hot, this unpredictable, moving rapidly. When we first got there, one of the things that amazed me as we were coming over the bypass, and for your listeners who are familiar with Lahaina, they know what the bypass is. And we went around the bend and looked down, and it was gone. And so...
It was gone. What was gone?
Lahaina. Lahaina was gone. The trees were gone. The palm trees looked like black needles. And for people familiar with Lahaina, the only thing standing was a smokestack. And so for a fire department to try to combat something that irregular, while they were trying to rescue people, so not just trying to put out a fire, but trying to rescue people and get them out, many people perished in their cars trying to get out because it was just so congested. There is one road that goes from West Maui into the center of the island, and that route was totally congested with people.
Wow. Are there any... sort of like a reverse FAQ, frequently asked question, are there any myths that you've heard or falsehoods that need correcting?
Oh, boy. Let me think about that one. Rebuilding, that's not a falsehood, but people have asked me frequently, well, have they rebuilt Lahaina yet? Well, no, they haven't. They lost 2,200 structures. So 2,200 structures is a whole lot of replacing. And their first task, after the fire was put out and after people were rescued, a couple of weeks after the fire, their first task was to go in and search through what was left to try to identify perished people. They were asking anybody that had somebody that you think they got lost in the fire, please give us your DNA, because they had to identify people with DNA. So that was the first thing that had to happen, and they were doing that the whole time we were there until the middle of September. When we left, they were still wading through the rubble trying to identify people. So that took forever. And then the second thing they had to do is clear the debris. And we went back in January and February of this year, and they had just started to clear the debris. And these poor guys that were in charge of that, it was hot. They had to wear hazmat suits. Keep in mind that everything was either melted or burned. So you've got hazardous material that these men and women were wading through trying to identify people and then remove debris. So that took forever to do. They have finally almost completed debris removal on all the homes, and they've gotten about half of the commercial buildings removed. So that has to be done before they can even start to rebuild. The sewer system has to be redone. The water system has to be redone. They have to get materials to rebuild. They've got to get building permits. They have finally, on the island of Maui, in the town of Lahaina, one person has started to rebuild their home. So, and it's been almost a year since it's happened. So it just takes a whole lot of time. Some of the local people look at this as sacred ground. So the the officials had to really step carefully because they looked at it as the burial grounds of their loved ones. And so you don't just wade in there with a bulldozer and start clearing stuff. So there were a whole lot of elements that were just unknown up until that point. How could you possibly predict that this would happen? And then how could you possibly predict the loss of life and how difficult it would be to wade through the remains and try to identify people?
That is, people can't see me. I'm shaking my head in disbelief and sadness and maybe a little bit of anger, too. As we begin to wrap up, what is your analysis of how the Lahaina is going to go forward and what can be done, if anything, to mitigate or prevent future events like this?
Well, they've already started working on how to prevent future things happening like this. They've upgraded their alarm system. So now they know that when you hear that sound go off, it could either be a tsunami or a wicked fire. So things like that, the perception of the people has changed. The education of people that when you hear this sound, get out. There's no improvement on the fact that there's one road that goes in and out of West Maui. So that they can't actually change or mitigate at all. Part of the problem, and keep in mind that this is an island we're talking about. So it's not like they can go to the next city and get their building materials. So that's a huge hurdle for people to get building materials to rebuild. Some of the people feel like it shouldn't be rebuilt. Some of the people who rented from a landlord who has decided to not rebuild. So their housing is just at an all-time crisis. As far as preventing that or helping with that, they're putting up temporary structures, but keep in mind that then they also have to do temporary sewer and water lines. So it's not just as simple as whipping up a house real quick so that somebody can move in. Some of the people whose homes were not destroyed but were damaged are trying to get the permits to get their homes fixed. So that's a whole nother element, that they're actual standing structures, but they're not usable.
Red tagged or whatever they call
it. Yeah, yeah. We have some dear friends who their home remained intact, but it had a hole in the roof. It burned a hole in the roof, but that was it. It didn't burn down the house. The house was still fully livable. Their furniture was still all intact. But then it rained into the hole in the roof. So then it ruined all of their furniture. And so there are a lot of people who had homes that they could have gone back to, but they couldn't get them fixed fast enough or get the permits or get the water and the sewer going back to their homes. So it wasn't just a singular problem. It's not just a singular problem. It's huge, huge implications on every single structure.
Wow. I guess all I can hope is that the people get relief, that their resilience and innovation serves as educational for other island communities and other areas that are at risk of wildfires.
Right.
Connie, you and I have been talking about the importance of helping Maui rebuild, and you've told me that in Lahaina in particular, but an entire island, they're desperately looking for an influx of tourism and tourists who bring their families but also bring money. The local economy is not good. And so if you're a tourist thinking of visiting Maui today or in the near future, please consider going there. They need your help. I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Connie Framberger, retired insurance executive, local resident, but also part-time resident of Maui in the Hawaiian Islands, and we were talking about the wildfires. Thank you so much, Connie.
My pleasure. My pleasure. If I could say one thing, it would be to encourage people to please visit Maui.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Working Lunch.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and your host today, and this is The Working Lunch. The SLO Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these Working Lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We hope you will join us for these conversations every month on KCBX's Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Vinay Clausen and Thane Atkinson. Vinay and Thane are both executive vice presidents for Vrantech Power Systems. Rantec Power Systems is a company headquartered in Los Osos that design and manufacture power systems for external contractors. Hello, Vinay and Thane. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us, Jim. Excited to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, appreciate you guys having us.
Well, it was near 70 years ago today that the origins of the Rantec company was founded in Southern California. The Rantec of today is an engineered solutions company of engineered power and electronic systems with expertise and capabilities in all aspects of design, manufacturing, and testing for Tier 1 contractors in the aerospace and military markets. So, Vinay and Thane, I just used some very technical terms in describing your business. When we say Rantec provides engineered power and electronic systems, what does that really mean? Are you talking outlets and plugs or something completely different?
So when we talk about power conversion solutions, we're talking about things that convert AC to DC or DC to DC power. So, you know, imagine something that what you'd use to charge your iPhone or computer. So, but we do that for high reliability and airspace applications. So, you know, imagine something that converts your AC wall power into a, you know, DC voltage that's on a USB plug.
It's very cool. So in that like usage, for instance, you mentioned aerospace. So on a plane, there's a main power system, but you need different types to power radar or audio. Is that kind of how that would work?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we typically take our, you know, airplane, you know, prime power and convert that down to very specific power that's needed for computers or displays or radar systems.
That's pretty cool. So let's kind of look at like what makes those power systems so specialized, or why do they need to be specialized? Why don't you just take the power that the plane provides and plug it straight into or any of the systems in there?
Yeah, good question, Jim. So our products are designed for tactical applications in pretty harsh environments. We support airborne, shipboard, ground-based defense applications, which often have fairly challenging requirements around several factors, things like size, weight, you know, environmental conditions like temperature, even weather. I think a good example is fifth generation fighter jets. We have several products that go into the F-35 that might require something like lightning protection, or variants of an M1A2 Abrams tank, which would need to require a ballistic impact. And our products are required and expected to continue operating under those types of harsh environments.
Think about even for just my normal house that's near the coast, right? Sea salt air, all that stuff that gets into and creates absolute havoc. You have to have power systems that are going to keep tanks, airplanes afloat, right, at high levels. So what are the tools you're using to create that stability? In layman's terms, obviously, I'm sure you can go very technical.
Yeah, so we do. We have a number of things we do, and it's all around how we design our products. So whether it's environmental protection and the things we do and put in place to protect against those kind of harsh environments you talked about, you know, salt fog, atmosphere, altitude, extreme temperatures. You know, we have a lot of different things that we do when we design a product to be able to, you know, make sure we can operate in that environment.
So again, the very safety of people are obviously in the hands of some of these power systems that are doing that work. So with how many things in a plane, or certainly when you're looking at the military applications, are digital and the growth of smaller personal craft, are you seeing growth for your products in the aircraft and helicopter markets, or is that just a change in size and space, a scope of aircraft, right? Instead of just, you know, all of them that would go into one giant plane, is it just kind of more in smaller units, or do we really see like growth in that marketplace of smaller personalized kind of aircraft and uses?
Yeah, I'd say our growth isn't really necessarily around the smaller personal aircraft. That's more along the lines of what's in the defense spending budget and where things are going from that perspective. A lot of things that we see are typically like technology refreshes and upgrade programs that are on existing platforms. So things like computers and radars, and as they're generating, you know, introducing new technologies and using the latest and greatest on these aircraft, that's kind of where we see ourselves. One thing, it's really challenging to actually get qualified on some of these platforms. And once you are and you develop the relationships and you establish yourself as a premier provider of you know, what we do, it makes it a lot easier for your customer to come back to you and say, hey, the next time we do this, we want to use you guys. Another thing that we do pretty regularly is invest in internal research and development projects. So that's to keep our technology current and competitive. So, we're able to provide the best value for our customers.
Well, yeah, and I imagine that is one of the hardest parts, right, is even just bridging into getting certified or qualified to be a vendor. And once you are, then you're understanding their needs because the world is changing so fast. And I'm sure you've got plenty of things you can't talk about. But, seeing so much of the unmanned work, unmanned like drones, aerial, those also in your scope? Or is that more, again, somebody else's and you're sticking to those established kind of models or that are existing right now?
It's definitely within, our scope of what we do. And, as that market expands in terms of, where the defense industry is looking to grow, their platforms from a drone perspective, that's definitely something that we're interested in and pursuing.
Yeah, it's so exciting, exciting world as we look around here of all the specialized manufacturing happening in SLO, a lot around that. So very interesting. But in my opening, I talked a little bit about that 70 years ago that Rantech was founded in Southern California, but now you're headquartered here in Los Osos. How did a business of that size kind of end up in Los Osos?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty cool story when you take a step back, Jim. So Rantech was founded in 1956, as you mentioned, Calabasas, actually, in Southern California. And for the next 44 years, really went through several different transitions, both being held by private and public entities. So in the 1990s, Rantech was a part of a standalone public company, ESCO, now ESCO Technologies. And in 2000, Rantech became Rantech Power Systems as a standalone division. In 2003, so a short time after that, there was a management buyout of Rantech Power Systems and formed RPS Holdings, which has been under the same ownership for 21 years now, which is a pretty great story. And it's been very advantageous for Rantech to have that leadership team in place. The owners have been with the company anywhere from 20 to 30 to even 40 years. In the case of our managing director and principal, he's been with the company for over 42 years now. So, that said, they know the industry very well. They know our customers, our products very well, and they've been able to reinvest in the business. So we are headquartered in Los Osos. We've actually expanded to three separate buildings within Los Osos now, and then actually moved into built and have a footprint in Layton, Utah as well. So it's a pretty cool story when you take a step back and look at Rantech, how it's grown and developed really over almost 70 years now, but the stability and growth that it's seen in the last 21 years under that ownership group.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Vinay Clausen and Thane Atkinson, Executive Vice Presidents of Rantech Power Systems, and we are talking about operating here in SLO County. Feels pretty special. Again, you talked about Los Osos, California, Layton, Utah. These are not normally your specialized manufacturing places. So it's so interesting to see how our economy continues to evolve, right? That you can do some of this great work. Some might think you're not able to even, how do you get all of the tools you need, energy, the tech you need out in Los Osos? But seems like you're being able to do that if you're expanding and moving in different parts. So, I'm sure there's challenges to being a little in the central coast of California, but seems like you're delivering great work. Does that seem accurate?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's challenging sometimes to find, bring, retain talent, on the central coast. In my opinion, I'm a central coast native. I was born in San Luis Obispo. Vinay and I actually both attended Cal Poly as well. Once you get here and you kind of learn, our landscape and what it offers you, it's a pretty darn great place to live, right? But it has been challenging. Obviously, COVID presented a unique set of challenges for us. And with that, we had to develop and evolve. And, now in some cases do offer some hybrid work. So, we really value face-to-face interactions and I think our culture really benefits from that. But there's certain opportunities that have allowed us to keep, highly talented folks in hybrid or potentially fully remote positions. So I think that's helped. I think what we've been able to do in the last several years is is hire and grow a high-performing team, really emphasizing Raintech's core values. So, you know, being able to provide constructive feedback to our team, setting realistic expectations for our teams, having better onboarding programs for folks as they come on board, and then also getting creative in our recruiting effort. So we've grown our recruiting team at Raintech, which has done, I feel like, a fantastic job in the last couple of years, you know, establishing contacts with Cal Poly, Cuesta, Slow Partners is another organization that we've utilized here. We've sponsored boot camps through that group before that really helps give them an inside look at Raintech, but also helps us build relationships with the students and kind of, you know, work with them through that course with the end result of hopefully bringing them on board at Raintech. So seen a, you know, pretty dynamic environment, but I think we've found ways to get creative and bring some great people on board.
Well, and it's one of those things that we always talk about with our folks who are part of the chamber is that, yeah, while there are challenges to this, you've shown just right there some really great ideas on how to bridge that gap. Talking about Slow Partners, that's a fabulous group in terms of, you know, upskilling folks to get to the things you need. Just real quick, how many employees do you have that work as part of Raintech?
We have about 210 employees.
Wow. As you were talking a little bit about Cal Poly, you talked about Cuesta, building this Slow Partners. I would assume your work focuses around that engineering power systems. Is that one of the reasons there's success here?
Yeah. So we use Cal Poly a lot for a lot of new grads. So we, you know, develop, you know, high potential individuals and, you know, make sure they have the right, you know, on the job training and support necessary. And, you know, a lot of, like Thane mentioned, both of us are Cal Poly grads. We have a lot of staff, both, you know, within, you know, all of our departments that are Cal Poly grads. So it's actually been a pretty great resource for us. Thane talked about Quest and Slow Partners. That's been really great for us. But from a recruiting perspective, we've had to put a lot of focus on that. We've had dedicated resources for recruiting, which has been a great help for us. And, you know, we have to look everywhere, right? So we have to look locally. We have to look for new hires. And then we have to look nationwide, you know, for specific roles. So, you know, recruiting is always a challenge. But, you know, we're making some good progress there.
Well, obviously, with 210, that's an awesome job. And so for a company like yours, as to, you know, it sounded like you talked a little bit about adjusting some of your work policies to ensure you're able to get and keep kind of a full team. Did you have to adjust up to that with, like, COVID we talked about, you know, remote work? You guys are one of our Blue Diamond family-friendly workplaces, which is one of the highest. Was that a strategy for you to kind of go out and get and keep talent?
Yeah, I think really twofold. So appreciate you mentioning that. You know, we've definitely grown. I think we've gone from a silver to a blue diamond family-friendly workplace, you know, over the course of the last couple of years. I think for two reasons. One is competitive, for sure, in the environment in San Luis Obispo and some of the industry that's here. I think two is also just doing right with our people and what's right for them. You spend a lot of time at work. You spend a lot of time around your coworkers. You want to have an environment that fosters constructive communication, accountability, teamwork, and you want to come to work every single day. So we took a look at that and adjusted different policies, our vacation and paid time off. You know, we enhanced a little bit. Paid parental leave was something we've added. So, you know, we have a dedicated mother's room on site, you know, in Los Osos as well. So we have an engagement survey that we actually run, you know, every year now and take those results seriously and take input from our, you know, from our teams and try and incorporate what they'd like to see. There's some company events we started doing as well. So, you know, summer events, we've sponsored the Air Fest actually in Santa Maria each of the last 2 years. It's been pretty cool, I think, for our teams. You know, first year we were there, they actually had a live demo of the F-35. So to see 200 people there and watch, you know, they're hands-on this product every single day and to see what it's actually capable of was a pretty cool feeling and getting them bought into a lot of the work that we do. So we've looked at doing a lot of that, which I think has helped, you know, recruiting and then also just engagement with our groups every day.
We talk a lot about that with our members is really about the cost of, you know, having to retrain, even if, you know, keeping people on staff who know what they're doing and getting at work as opposed to trying to get new people in and retrain them and get them up to speed has an incredible value. you went from that silver level all the way up to blue diamond, which is incredible for a company. And you talked about an engagement survey. I like that. So is that kind of just an annual thing to check in, or how does your company kind of do that?
Yeah, good question. So there's several different ways to do it. What's worked well for us is company-wide engagement survey that's broken down by the different departments that we have. So, you know, within the business development group, within the engineering group, within the operations group, our quality department, finance group, and within that, different substructures that's completely anonymous and sitting down and getting to take some dedicated time to fill out lists of questions around workplace safety, around opportunities to learn and grow, around trust in the direction that the company's headed, and provide some open-ended feedback on, you know, what folks are either really happy with coming to work every single day or where there's some areas of opportunity. So, you know, that's revisited. Actually, we're coming up on pretty soon in the next couple months. We'll be doing our 2024 one. And I think, you know, we really look at our teams and us to be accountable to taking that feedback, you know, to heart and listening to it. And there's going to be some things that we can't always change. But I think, you know, sharing maybe why we can or can't do that, and then ensuring that there are areas that we're continually striving to improve has been valuable. So that's how we approach it and look at it as a team.
When you're able to have that conversation, like you said, sometimes you can't deliver those things, but here's why. And man, that understanding for employees helps them. So congrats. That is really great. I'd like to end with a little bit of forecasting kind of about the future. Since you're getting a great view, kind of future-focused contracts and work, what are the economic opportunities and challenges maybe you see coming down the road for us on the Central Coast over the coming years?
So, I mean, from our business perspective, you know, we have good visibility into, you know, kind of some longer term, you know, our the programs we're on or, you know, usually they're forecasted out pretty long, so you can kind of see where those are going. We're on some pretty, you know, premier platforms that have long lifespan to them. And at the end of the day, you know, our primary, you know, I'd say responsibility is to make sure that we're, you know, providing our customers and eventually the warfighter with, you know, a good quality product that we deliver on time that's providing them the tools that they need to do their job, right? And so, you know, from a forecast, it's really the geopolitical environment and how those things, you know, is it going to pan out and what, you know, the DoD budget really dictates. But, you know, because we are established here, we've been around for so long, we have a solid reputation within the industry. You know, I think, you know, we're seeing our business continue to grow here. And, you know, I think that that means, you know, further, you know, expansion where we need to. You know, obviously resources are always going to be, you know, people resources are going to be a big part of our business. And so, you know, along with what we're on today, looking for new opportunities, like we talked about with the unmanned aircraft and other things that are coming out from a technology perspective, those are always things that we're looking for. But, you know, from a challenges side of things, I think we're going to have the same challenges, right? You know, it's a relatively remote part of the state, right? We're not a big metropolitan area, you know, so cost of living, housing, right, are always going to be things that are going to be challenges for us. So we'll work through them. And you know, at the end of the day, we got to figure out how to make it happen.
If folks want to learn more about how to become part of the Rantech team or learn more about your products, what's the best way for them to learn about that?
Yeah. You know, I think the best way really is going online. If you Google Rantech or Rantech Power Systems, you'll find us. And there's a ton of information about our products, the industry, who we are, what we do. A lot of different open roles right now that we're looking at. So I encourage you, you know, to take a peek there. And there's ways to reach out, contact us either through phone or email or application just online. So you'll find a lot of helpful resource there and fill you in a little bit more about what we're about what we do. And if you're interested, potentially joining the team.
Thank you so much, Vinay and Thane, for joining us today and sharing some of your thoughts. To you, our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Vinay Clausen and Thane Atkinson of Rantech Power Systems, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the San Luis Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, C-suite consultant Harpreet Gooman shares her life journey and her new book, Living and Loving Unapologetically.
Ms. Harpreet Gooman, was born and raised and educated in India before emigrating to America, and after a stint in the San Francisco Bay Area, settled in the village of Arroyo Grande. Ms. Guman's work history included leading Oracle-based enterprise learning systems of more than 30,000 learners at Vodafone, developing and coaching C-suite executives and senior teams in various high-tech industries into an industry consultancy business. Harpreet melded lessons learned throughout her life journey into a new book, Living and Loving Unapologetically, a call to action for women dare to forge their own path. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Harpreet Guman? This is a new book, just came out, right?
That's right. This is a proof copy. It's getting launched on July 23rd.
This is a new book, but it's an old book for you in that it's about your life journey and lessons learned and how you can share those with other people. Let's go back in time. You were born and raised in India, and you went to school there, and then what happened?
So I grew up in a very loving and progressive family in India. On dinner table, individuality and spirited debates were really encouraged. Education was important, so was having an opinion. I was never forced to conform to traditional career paths like being a doctor or an engineer.
They didn't push you in any direction?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think it was extremely important for my parents, for me and my brother, to have a voice, to have an opinion. So I feel I was very privileged to have taken birth in a place where I could be who I wanted to be in a world where everybody is trying to change you. Patriarchy did not exist at a home. My dad ensured that women had dominant voices, and he cherished that.
That's really interesting. He was an army colonel in the Indian Army.
Correct.
And there's some paradoxes there in that he was at the same time very evolved and very open. Explain that.
That's an interesting question. I never thought about that way, you know, being in the Indian Army, where it's all about hierarchy. I think he was a very spiritual person. And for some reason, I think he wanted my mom to be the queen of the house. So he knew that I'm the bread, earning member of the family. But two kids, if you ask us, we thought a mom was taking all the shots, right? Though right. My mother was master's and she was a teacher in a school. But every 2 years we would move because my dad would get posted out. My mom's career would suffer. And I think maybe that was my dad's way of compensating. So, you know, allowed her to be the queen of the house and matriarch of the house.
In a way, a saving grace for you. And for how you matured and figured your life out, you had a cool foundation to start from.
Absolutely. I can't thank enough. I have so much of gratitude, you know, to have my parents. And absolutely. And another thing that comes to my mind, my dad would often joke. He says, what is this generation gap, right? It's the distance that we create. So he would often say, let's hear to the kids. He would tell mom, I'm sure what they know, we don't know. He was always curious, so that really allowed us. It wasn't like the decisions would be made at his level. Mm-hmm. He would involve us. Every decision involved each one of us.
Well, how many kids were there?
Oh, I have an older sibling, just two of us. You're talking about...
Yeah, your family, yeah.
Oh, so just older brother?
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to university, and when you started, what did you think you were going to do?
I had no freaking clue what I would be doing, and interestingly, there was no pressure, unlike Indian parents, right, to be a doctor or be an engineer, right, all this way. I think we were just exposed to all the sports. We were exposed to as many activities we could. We were just told to give our best and just expand our perspective. I remember clearly in my first job, I didn't know what should I expect and what I should not expect. And it was a very unconventional role at that time, doing an MBA in 2000. Right? So because I was allowed to pursue my own dreams.
That's really interesting. You went right to work after graduating with your MBA?
Yes.
Yeah. What did you do?
So I did my MBA in marketing and I started my job, telecom company, which is Vodafone right now. Vodafone was very new. Telecom was very new in 2000. My job was training all the frontliners, right? that was the beginning of it. I started my career in marketing, but somehow I realized that I have flair of developing people, coaching people, hand-holding people. And that's how my career turned to learning and development. Mm-hmm. So my last job back in India in a big multinational company where I was leading and heading an OD function, my job was basically to help company meet their business goals by developing their individuals and teams.
As I told you about my friend, Mr. Krishnamurti from India, he told me about growing up and how the parents typically would tell you who you were going to marry. So culturally, you were kind of unique and you dodged that bullet.
I've had a very unconventional life growing up in India. And again, I would credit my parents. Unlike my cousins, they all had a pressure of getting married at 21, 22, 23. I didn't. I got married at the age of 42. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in my plan to stay unmarried for that long, but I wasn't willing to get married for the heck of it.
So no compromising.
No compromising. Mm-hmm. And I think for some reason, my parents allowed me to connect to who I am. They would, of course, once in a while, the question would come in. But once I got into my 30s, they said, she's independent, she's enjoying her life, you know, mm-hmm. and she's good.
In spite of you being blessed with your acculturation in the family, you talk about in your book some of the barriers and some of the things that you have to overcome as a woman in the world, in the workplace. Talk to us about that.
So as a single woman, it adds to the complexity. Most of the time back in the organization, my character was assassinated. Instead of giving credit to my intelligence mm-hmm. and the value that I brought in,
was it twofold in that you have corporate hierarchy, so there are people always gunning for you, just power and control, whether you're male or female, but then you layer on that female dynamic and you have a whole nother target?
If I look back, I worked in the organizations which were heavily male-dominated, right? I was the only, mostly all the time, in the leadership meetings or the groups. Honestly, I did not feel I was the only. I did not put focus or energy on being the only. I put focus and energy on the value that I brought in. So yes, there were challenges. And I think I was not a giver. I was not willing to let go. Mm-hmm. So things were challenging. I'm saying today that yes, there was glass ceiling, but I think I was successful in smashing glass ceiling one after the other. I feel what helped me was not having a victim mentality and not bringing my gender in any way. If a man said something to me, I did not like it, I would not make a big issue out of it that, oh, I'm a gender. What's the problem? I did not like it. Let me tell him, hey, I did not like it. And sometimes it was an unconscious statement by that person. That person didn't even realize what he meant. So
cultural conditioning.
And the cultural conditioning back in India, patriarchy, mm-hmm. you know, where the dominant voice of the house is usually your father, which was unlike in my case. And in the organizations, right, the leader, and the leader was men. So it was hard sometimes for them to have disagreements by a woman.
You have done some consulting. Talk to us about that dynamic of your career.
So I moved to the U.S. in 2021, and I often joke about career change, country change, relationship change. Bring it on, middle of the COVID. So that was a big job. Blessing in disguise. You would have never left a job where you have a paycheck coming in. Things are hunky-dory. You're doing well. People recognize the work that you bring to the table. So I took this as an opportunity, which I always wanted to do something of my own. So I started my practice unapologetically, Harpreet, in the U.S. There are three parts to it. I design and facilitate solutions for organizations. I coach senior leaders transitioning to the C-level.
These are major corporations that you're talking about.
Major corporations. I also teach at Harvard Business Review. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really passionate about is, and I feel fortunate, again, that I'm able to do, is to work with women. My personal purpose is to create a better world by including women in all the places where policies, decisions, strategies are being made. And I feel it's even more critical now. We are facing irreversible changes, climate changes, species extinctions, war, etc.
Back in time in India, you had a female head of state, Indira Gandhi.
100 years back.
Yeah. So you guys were really advanced in that modality.
Absolutely. And somewhere we lost it, right? Though we had Indira Gandhi as the first woman prime minister, and we lost it, and things have picked up now. Yeah.
So you feel optimistic going forward?
I've always been optimistic, and I'm very clear. I'm not going to wait for patriarchy or systems to get fixed. I strongly believe change inside me creates the change outside. I'm a big optimist person.
So that's something that you teach intrinsic in your message. Let's go back to your book, Living and Loving Unapologetically. It's a tutorial. It's a hands-on life lessons. Talk to us about what's in the book.
So my real goal with this book is to help women rediscover themselves, the dreams that got buried long time back while they were busy supporting or fulfilling dreams of their partner or kids or aging parents, helping them step into leadership role with confidence, helping them create a life that they truly want with joy. And this book actually provides insights, stories, and strategies.
Give us some examples, some hands-on.
So it talks about, you know, one will require to break all the rules to create your own story, right? If you want to make a change, you will have to create your own rule book. What does that look like? Like for me, I created my own rule book. I did not have no in my dictionary. I did not have the words like why me exist. So what are those words that look like for you? It's more like a journal, like a coaching compact capsule. So, you know, while I'm sharing my own stories, I put it back to the readers. How about you? What's going on for you?
Mm-hmm. How would you approach this problem?
How would you approach this? Mm-hmm. What is your fairy tale life? What is coming in your way? While I've said, this is what worked for me, not necessarily it would work for you. So what is showing up for you? So by sharing stories of my own journey of navigating personal and corporate life as a single woman and experiences of successful corporate women across the globe, I came up with this book.
Do you do seminars? You do?
So I do keynote sessions. Mm-hmm. I do webinars. I do cohort-based programs for women. As I said, I'm on an unstoppable mission. I can't see a woman unhappy. And I really hope that a woman, when she reads this book, she is moved to take some step, even if that's a baby step. That would be a big achievement for me.
You live in Arroyo Grande. How did that happen? Why did you choose the Central Coast?
So that's funny. So my husband was based out of the Bay Area, and when I decided I'm not going to do 9 to 5, so we said, okay, we can move to Pismo Beach. Right? COVID was there. Everybody, anyways, you know, was getting too tired of the cities. And for me, I told my husband, you know, for me, it doesn't make a difference. I've left my country. Any place would be beautiful. And mm-hmm. by the beach, it's going to be excellent. So when we moved in, the first place where I lived was Pismo Beach for 3 months. And I'm a terrible co-driver. I must admit that. Right? We were going somewhere and I gave some wrong directions to my husband. And that happened to be Arroyo Grande, and both me and my husband were like, oh, this place looks good. This has good houses. That's how AJ happened, because everybody's like, how did you discover AJ? Mm-hmm. So sometimes your imperfections lead to such beautiful things, and you're very happy about it.
Yeah, I love the old town in Arroyo.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, like a small town, little village.
Yeah, we're right in the village. So we love that area. We're very happy to be here.
How does somebody learn more about you?
So the book is getting launched on 23rd of July. People can visit my website, www.unapologeticallyharpreet, to get more details when we get closer to the launch. Readers can follow me on LinkedIn, Harpreet Kumman. And I'm looking forward to hearing some unapologetic stories from amazing women out here.
Harpreet, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure to be here.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We've been speaking with Harpreet Kumman, the author of Living and Loving Unapologetically, Fearless Women Leaders. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.